Communications, Inc., Petitioner versus Federal Communications Commission et al. Mr. Smith for petitioner, Ms. Citrin for the respondents, and Mr. Price for the intervener.
May it please the court, my name is Lex Smith. I am here on behalf of Sandwich Isles Communications. I have asked to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. In 2005, the Federal Communications Commission issued an order. That order said a number of things about the plan of Sandwich Isles Communications to create a new telecommunication network linking the 6 main Hawaiian islands. That it's found that that plan was in the public interest.
So you're talking about the Bureau's order in 2005?
That's correct, Your Honor. I apologize.
You're talking about the waiver, the study area waiver.
That's right, Your Honor. And so what I'm talking about is what they actually, clearly the ordering clause of that order did not say we approve the plan. But I think if you look at that order and you look at what it says it's in the public interest for Sandwich Isles Communications to build this network. It says that Sandwich Isles Communications should receive support for building the network.
Where does it say that?
What JA page?
It says that Sandwich Isles recently submitted a multi-million-dollar broadband loan application to RUS, the federal government, for new construction. It doesn't say they got it. In fact, they didn't get it.
Pardon me, it doesn't say what?
It doesn't say they got it from RUS, and in fact, they didn't.
What I said was they said it's in the public interest for SIC to receive support for the network.
What do you mean support? It says that they get a waiver of the existing situation and then go ahead and try and pursue that, but there's nothing that, whereby the FCC indicates that it is providing the resources or the legal authority to actually operate.
That order says that SIC is entitled to support.
Where does that say that?
Your Honor, I'll find the exact page.
I'm reading it right.
I think we're on JA-34.
JA-30, I see right here. I don't see anything.
It's the order favors support for Sandwich Isles. It does not, as I said, as I conceded up front, it does not expressly say that this plan is endorsed or supported, but the overall...
All of the FCC Bureau decides that they will grant a waiver from the existing situation so that Sandwich Isles can pursue their dream.
Or can receive support. That's right, Your Honor.
What does it say, receive support?
I apologize. I don't have the police in front of me, but I'll bring it back to you on rebuttal.
I've got it here. I don't see anything about received support.
And they say you're going to have to make large capital investments, and they say, therefore, it's in the public interest for Sandwich Isles and its customers to benefit from the cost savings and lower rates available through NEPA participation. That's all I see.
The purpose of the waiver is so that Sandwich Isles can receive support.
The purpose of the waiver could just be to allow Sandwich Isles to continue participating in NECA, which is what this says. And this is, in, as I understand the chronology, this was issued 2 years before you undertook the new cable.
I suppose that depends on the what you say about undertook. We have provided you, we've cited the letter that NECA actually wrote in the year 2000, which indicated that they were fully aware of the plan to build the cable, and that letter expressly said that there should not be a problem receiving support for it. So I think it's a little bit of a distraction or a confusion for NECA to try to tell the court that they first heard about this in 2007 and they didn't have any, and at that point they said, wait a minute.
Even if they did know, and even if the association had, even if they had signed off, does that bind, what authority is that for binding either the Bureau or the Commission? Does the association have that ability?
I'm not saying that NECA was bound necessarily by that order. What I am saying, though, is
No, what I'm asking is if the association, if we read the association's decision.
Right, or their letter.
Letter in your favor, read it just as you read it.
Right.
The question here is whether the commission's decision should be sustained, and does the association have any, I'm trying to figure out the relationship between the association's view and the commission or the Bureau, going through the Bureau first and then to the commission.
Would the
association bind either one?
I don't have authority that they're bound by what they say. Mm-hmm. The statute itself says, the 1996 amendments to the statutes say that the support that's provided for rural telecommunications is to be specific, sufficient, and predictable. What I'm really suggesting here is that there was a change. Somewhere between 2005 and 2016, there was a change. I submit to you, the project was supported in 2005 and before, and it wasn't in 2016.
Well, you keep saying supported. Your original waiver request said you were going to get the money from RUS.
Yes, Your Honor.
You never got the money from RUS.
That's true. It was privately
financed.
You
got the money from Deutsche Bank, and I must say, as an ex-banker, I am utterly astonished that any bank would have given a loan on this one.
Deutsche Bank hired their own cost consultant, looked at the law.
They have to speak for themselves to whatever regulators they have in Germany. But in any event, there's nothing about the FCC providing support for this. It was supposed to be coming from RUS, the federal government, and the federal government refused.
The way the system works, the system that is mandated by the Communications Act, as amended by the 1996 amendments, is that the RUS provides the loans for these things.
But the RUS refused.
I'm just trying to explain. The RUS provides, you're right that RUS refused, but the funds to service the debt come from the FCC. So in this case, the
funds for service the debt come from the FCC?
That's correct, Your Honor.
The money actually flows from a check from the FCC?
But I beg your pardon?
I don't understand. You're saying the FCC actually provides money for this?
Yes, the FCC provides funds called universal service funds.
Not for the construction.
Correct, to service the debt that was incurred for the construction.
Do they ever agree? Did the FCC ever agree to that?
It was NECA that was supposed to do it, which
now you've got me confused.
Okay, you're right. There are multiple mechanisms under the law for providing universal service. This whole statute exists because the big telecoms, who are all here today, won't service rural areas because it's not economic. So they need subsidies in order to provide the service. The funds for the service come from a couple of different places. the Universal Service Funds that come from the FCC, and NECA. The 2005 order expressly said you should join NECA because you'll be able to get support for this program through them. So there were funds from NECA as well as Universal Service Funds, which really aren't the subject of this case today. So something happened between 2005 and 2016.
Dispute the notion that regulated industries must show used and useful tests with respect to expenditures?
What I would say about that is that when a company puts in a new cable, they don't put it in for just the amount of capacity they have that day. They need to be able to put in more.
You put in a cable, which absolutely astonished me. Was able to provide service, both telephone and other kinds of service, to everybody in the state of Hawaii. In order to reach 2,000 people.
That's true. Under today's standards, at the time of the design, the multiplexing technology has advanced greatly since that time, so that it looks much more outrageous today than it did at the time. But the other point about that is that the incremental expense.
I hate to say this, but I agree with you. It is much more outrageous, meaning that it was outrageous at the time.
The incremental expense between putting in, say, a 12 fiber cable and putting in a 48 fiber cable is negligible.
You could lease as you had on existing cables.
The existing cables are voice quality, not modern quality. They're at the end of their life cycle. Something was going to have to be done on this anyway. Those things were all recognized by the RUS when they originally gave their approval for the loan.
Hawaii Telephone doesn't operate adequate service?
That's correct, Your Honor. Their undersea cables are, as I say, at the end of their life cycle, and the leased lines that they provide are of poor quality. And that was recognized by the RUS approval.
Let me ask you another question about your sort of settlement offer, $8.1 million. You don't have any agreement on that, do you?
An agreement on?
The $8.1
million. We had an agreement, but it's not been signed, and that's the reason it was not submitted.
You don't have an agreement.
Okay, fair enough. We don't have a signed agreement. We did reach a handshake agreement with them. I see that my time is up. Mm-hmm. We'll
give you some time for
hold on for rebuttal.
You have a lot of pilakia.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Sarah Citrin for the FCC. This is not a case about the FCC's Universal Service Subsidy Program. It's a case about what ratepayers should pay for the services they purchase, and it's a case that arises from Sandwich Isles' decision to build the largest undersea cable in Hawaii, which, as Judge Silverman said, had the capacity to serve every landline subscriber in the state when Sandwich Isles served less than 1% of those subscribers. And the question for the court is whether the FCC reasonably determined that Sandwich Isles has not met its burden to justify recovering the full cost of that cable through pooling. Sandwich Isles has challenged the reasonableness of the Commission's decision on two narrow Administrative Procedure Act grounds. It says first that the Commission improperly ignored evidence concerning the renegotiation of its lease costs, which it says it could total in full $8.1 million. And it says that the Commission departed without sufficient explanation from the 2010 declaratory ruling of its subordinate bureau.
In 2000, the association, NECA, notified Sandwich Isles that, based on information it had received, quote, it is reasonable to assume, this is a JA-148, it is reasonable to assume that Sandwich Isles Communications will receive the estimated NECA settlements throughout the projected period.
So
what do you do with that?
I think that assurance, whatever it meant to NECA at the time, and I'm not entirely sure, but I don't believe that it binds the commission later.
I get that. I'm not sure. Is that right, that what the association decides just has no binding impact on
the Bureau process?
Commission? It's an odd relationship.
The process, as I understand it, for the costs included in NECA's pool, NECA makes an initial determination, and the commission, they file annual tariffs, which, if challenged, the commission would review de novo NECA's assessment of the reasonableness of the costs. But that didn't happen here. It happened later.
AT&T challenged?
No, what happened actually in this context was not at the time of the filing of a tariff, but Sandwich Isles and NECA had been seeking from 2007 to 2009 to resolve whether these costs were.
Who first challenged it?
Sandwich Isles brought a petition for declaratory ruling to the commission.
Because NECA was refusing to pay that?
That's right.
All right. So that was in 2005?
Nine. 2009.
2009.
So at that point, Sandwich Isles.
That's 9 years after this letter.
That's 9 years after this letter. The Paniolo Cable was. The chronology is that Sandwich Isles decided to lease the Paniolo Cable, conceived of and decided to lease the Paniolo Cable in 2007, and that's when it initiated this back and forth with NECA, which ultimately led to the petition before the commission.
Well, what do we make about this 2000 letter?
I don't think it's relevant to the court's decision today, and in fact, I don't think the question of reliance at all is the question on which the APA challenges in this case turn. Briefly, as to the 2005 order,
Hang on a second. I mean, their argument is about, hey, look, we were told we were getting at least 50% of this stuff, and then everything changed 5 or 6 years later between the Bureau and the Commission, and then so they're told one thing in 2000, then another thing in 2005, and something totally different in 2011. And just to understand how this scheme works, maybe not with respect to the specific case, but capital investments aren't something one can do on little 12-month spurts. And so how are people supposed to, I think that's what their argument about the unexplained switch is look, we're making a capital investment here. It's a long-term investment. We went to the association in 2000, got some kind of green light, debate about what they got there, and then 2005 they got 50%, and a decade later, 11 years later, the commission pulls a plug on the whole thing. But it's a little hard to undo all that capital investment 11 years later.
Well, because the commission wasn't involved in 2000 and with this NECA letter, I don't really know. I see what they've quoted, and I understand Sandwich Isles' understanding of what NECA was representing. I don't know. But what I do know
is the commission doesn't act, by statute, when the commission does not act, which it
but there was
do
no
for 6 years, then the Bureau's orders shall have the same force and effect and shall be made evidence and enforced in the same manner as orders, decisions, reports of the commission. So what are people supposed to rely on in trying to make capital investments with a scheme like this? They're told to rely on the Bureau. The commission doesn't act. That's what holds. 6 years, you're getting 50%, and then someone pulls the rug out from under their feet.
So that question, as I understand it, goes to reliance on the 2010 order, and I think there.
The cable had been built long before the 2010 order, so it's impossible for petitioner to argue that it relied on the 2010 order to build the cable.
Chronologically, that's right. And furthermore, the 2010 order was immediately appealed.
No, but they say the 2000 letter.
What do we know about the cable time of this 2000 letter, order, whatever it was that Judge Millett's been asking you about. So my understanding is they conceived the cable in 2007 and had it built by 2009.
Right.
Is there anything circa 2000 where they're not just coming in and saying, let us into NECA, but saying, hey, we want to build this super duper expanded new cable?
No. And my understanding is the first NECA heard of the Paniolo cable was in 2007, but that earlier there may have been discussion with NECA about building a network in Hawaii.
Well, does the record, I'm a little confused about, because there's this 2000 letter, then in the study area waiver, there's certainly a recognition, at least, that they were going to have to make expensive capital investments. So somebody must have thought something was going to happen. Now, maybe it changed, maybe it became ballooned in 2007 or not, but what I found very confusing about this case is I can't figure out the basic who knew what, when question, and all we got was, well, don't pay attention to anything the Bureau said because the Commission gets to review it 6 years later, and that seemed to me a rather cavalier answer to this problem.
Well, I think on the 2005 order and what the Commission was looking at there, Judge Katz has understood it correctly, that the Commission understood that Sandwich Isles was thinking to undertake large capital investments and that there was it was in the public interest to allow Sandwich Isles to participate in the Universal Service Program and to join to be part of the NECA pool. But that was not an assessment of any particular facilities or whether those facilities were used and useful to ratepayers, and that didn't come, Judge Silberman, as you've said, until 2 years later.
No, I get that, but so what were they thinking when they said, because part of the benefit of NECA is that these small companies can group together because it's really hard for any one of them to bear the capital expenses. And I get the argument that, Lordy, nobody knew it was $24.1 million when that showed up later, but is there anything in the record that tells us what, if there's a finding here that they're going to have to make expensive capital investments that are expensive enough, they can't sort of hand it all on their own, they need to join NECA.
There's nothing in the record of this case about what, if anything, specifically Sandwich Isles told the Commission in 2005 about the exact nature of its facilities, but what we can be sure of from the chronology is that Sandwich Isles could not have presented the cost of these facilities.
Okay, so it didn't say, here's the Paniolo cable plan. What if, just hypothetically, what if, as part of that 2000 letter from the association and this 2005 study area waiver, when they said we need to be in, we're going to have a lot of expensive capital costs, if they'd given notice that we're talking, we think somewhere in the range of 15 to 25 million, if that were in the record, would people be able to rely on that?
You know, the notion of reliance that Sandwich Isles is advancing, which again, I don't really think is one of the legal issues in the case, but I also don't think it can be right in the abstract hypothetical sense, because the implication would be that whatever enormous investment was approved at some early stage in time, however useless it turned out to be, and whatever anticipated benefit did not materialize for ratepayers, that they could be on the hook for the cost of those facilities.
That makes perfect sense. The problem is when the FCC takes 6 years to act, and you're talking about capital investments, what are people supposed to do?
Well,
if it's that easy, why does it take 6 years and reopening the record to answer that question?
In this case, Judge Millett, the investment was before any delay by the Commission, and the delay in this case, if anything, benefited Sandwich Isles because the Commission did not claw back those payments.
That's not my point. My point is they were told then the 2010 when the Bureau said they could get the 50%,
right?
And then it was 6 more years before the Commission said no. I get that they didn't make it retrospective. That would be a much harder case. That's a good answer to reliance, but I'm just trying to understand the scheme and how it's supposed to work. If your theory of don't rely And what the Bureau did for your capital investments, because we can pull the rug out from under you 6 years later if we get some new facts and decide differently. I'm just asking generically, not even specifically with this, you know, this case, in the context of this case, but how is the system supposed to work?
Well, I'm not sure if it would work differently in the situation where someone had challenged the tariff before it went into effect, but I think that delay is a function of the way that the case developed here, which was by this petition for declaratory ruling, and there is no...
So if no one had ever challenged this, then you could have just gone on, the Commissioner Bureau don't do any independent review, they just start cutting the checks for the $24
million? The tariff, if it is approved in this streamlined process, that's the system. The rate is approved, the tariff is approved on a streamlined basis.
I'm a little confused. Did anybody challenge the tariff?
No one challenged the tariff. No, it was
the tariff put in by the tariff is put in by NECA.
That's right, on behalf of
it's a nationwide tariff. Right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Yes. But somebody was challenging the used and useful aspect of this cable. Who was it?
Well, NECA was refusing to approve the inclusion of these costs.
That's what I thought.
And NECA? Then Sandwich Isles came.
That's right. So NECA refused to accept these costs.
That's right.
And that's why it pushed Sandwich Isles to petition for a declaratory ruling from the FCC in 2010.
That's right.
Yeah. So let me just try a different way of getting at Judge Millett's point. Company is contemplating a major capital investment, and let's assume for purposes of the hypothetical, it's a close case whether that makes economic sense or not.
Mm-hmm.
What are they supposed to do to get the blessing before they invest all of that money? Is it get a declaratory ruling and go all the way through NECA up to the board, up to the FCC, and if they don't do all of that, they proceed at their own risk?
That's right.
What are they supposed to do if it takes a decade to get through that process?
You can't do
capital investments that way.
Well, they always have recourse, if nothing else, to a petition for mandamus to this court. I don't think here the record shows that Sandwich Isles was complaining about the delay. And as I said, that may be because the delay in this case
wasn't to their benefit.
That's right. If there are no further questions, I ask that the petition for review be denied. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Daniel Fife for Intervenor AT&T.
May I ask you a question concerning your interest in this case? I was a little confused by the briefs, but if there's a payment to Sandwich Isles, it comes, I thought from the brief, it comes out of the pool. It doesn't increase the total payments into the pool. It comes out of the pool, so therefore it's taken from other small carriers all across the country.
Let me clarify that for you, Judge Silverman. The costs that Sandwich Isles recovers from the pool affect the overall rates that the pool members charge, and those rates are then passed on to inter-exchange carriers.
So it's not a zero-sum game, whereby if Sandwich Isles gets a certain approval, the total rates go up. It looked from the briefs that it was a zero sum. If Sandwich Isles got it, it came away from the pool and came away from smaller carriers all across the country.
I think it's fair to say that it's zero sum in two respects. First is the basic respect that any money Sandwich Isles gets is coming out of ratepayers' pockets. But it's also
from the small carriers around the country.
From the inter-exchange carriers and the customers of those small carriers around the country. And it's
the inter-exchange or the access? You're talking about the local carriers.
The local carrier, the cost of Sandwich Isles recovers from the pool affect the rates that those local carriers charged to ratepayers. So it's zero sum.
Yes, but I didn't see it affected the rates they charge the state carriers.
So it affects the access. It affects the interexchange carriers through the access charges.
They actually go up.
They actually go up. Yes.
So that presents your. That, so you do have an economic interest.
Yes, that's correct. I'd like to turn to the reliance interests that the court was asking about. I wanted to first address the 2000 NECA letter and make 2 points respecting it. The first is that, I unfortunately don't have a direct citation to the record on this, but the 2000 letter, in addition to the comments that the court asked about, stated and warned Sandwich Isles that consistent with FCC and NECA rules, Sandwich Isles would still have to, on a going forward basis, justify its costs annually as NECA requires. And that's consistent with the basic used and useful principle that on an ongoing basis, carriers need to show that the costs that they are recovering from ratepayers are benefiting ratepayers. The second point is that the 2000 letter was by no means NECA's last word on this investment before Sandwich Isles decided to enter it. When Sandwich Isles came to NECA in 2000 before signing the Paniolo lease, NECA warned that the cost...
2000?
I'm sorry, in 2007, I apologize. Yeah. When Sandwich Isles came to NECA in 2007, before signing the lease, NECA warned Sandwich Isles that the costs and capacity of the cable appear excessive. It also warned about the affiliate, it raised concerns about the affiliate transactions.
And this is an important point. The Paniola was built by another company.
Yes.
Not Sandwich Isles.
Yes, the Paniola cable was built
now,
by a
there's
company.
There's a disturbing interrelationship, but nevertheless, it's a separate company. And the FCC is not approving, didn't have Paniola before it at any time. It only had Sandwich Isles.
That's correct. Paniola came on the scene in 2007.
No, my point is
separate company.
And Paniola never appeared before the FCC, did it?
That's correct.
That's right. It's a separate company altogether. They put its own money into this deal, deal on the comms, I assume.
Yes, that is correct. Paniola secured
private. Did it do it because it had an agreement with? I mean, that sort of makes a question whether it was agreeing to do the building at Sandwich Isles' behest. If those two had, I mean, imagine a scenario in 2000 where Sandwich Isles said, and we just, seems like we don't quite know, goes to the association and says, we've got to build this network, including the submarine cable, and it's going to cost XX million, double digits, maybe not the exact right price. And the association blesses it in the letter. And the Sandwich Isles goes and finds a contractor to build this thing. And they have long-term, it takes a while to get the negotiations to get the thing going. But it's being built by another company.
Not a contractor.
Then
somebody, it's not a contractor.
They have a contract with somebody to build it.
Yeah.
Right. And they have to, Sandwich Isles isn't going to build it itself. And then 2005, they've got their view. I guess there's different readings of their view, and they think they're still getting another nod now from the commission to make capital investments. And then by the time, 2007, they go, okay, here's the bill, or here's what we think the bill's going to be. We've been doing what you all said was okay, and of course we told you it was going to be expensive. Here's the bill, and that's when everyone goes, oh my gosh, way too much. So the fact that it's another company doesn't really matter so much. The question is whether Sandwich Isles was reasonable to get into that relationship and have that obligation to have infrastructure built for its service. Through the used and useful lens, I mean.
Yes, a couple points in response. I think that first, as a matter of chronology, Sandwich Isles lost funding to build the Paniolo cable, or to build what ultimately became the Paniolo cable in 2004.
Be very, very careful about this. My understanding is Sandwich Isles built nothing. Paniolo, a separate company, built the cable. Paniolo was never in front of the FCC. Am I not correct?
Yes, that is technically correct. Yes.
They were building it for Sandwich Isles.
or anybody. Anybody could use that cable, right?
Well,
my telephone could use that cable, right?
In principle, yes, except that Sandwich Isles in 2007, despite warnings from NECA that it might not be able to recover all of the costs of the cable through the NECA pooling arrangement, entered an exclusive lease.
Why do you keep talking about it recovering the cost of the cable?
Because
you're assuming, are you making the same mistake that the other side makes, which you try to distinguish in your brief? Paniola is not before the FCC. Sandwich Isle didn't build the cable.
That's correct, but Sandwich Isles is now seeking to recover its lease costs on the
cable. Ah, its lease costs, that's right.
Right.
Not the construction cost, its lease cost.
Yes. And because Sandwich Isles entered an exclusive lease for the cable's entire capacity.
When did they do this? This is part of my who knew what when. Do we know when they agreed to do, was it 2007 that they agreed to enter into that exclusive lease for this
yes.
massive cable?
Yes, and I think that's a key point, is that
okay.
in 2007, they've lined up the financing from Deutsche Bank. They've approached NECA. NECA has warned them that the costs might not all be recoverable through the pool because the costs and capacity seem so excessive.
Wait a minute.
Despite
you keep saying they.
Sorry. NECA has warned Sandwich Isles.
No, wait. Sandwich Isles did not get a loan from Deutsche Bank.
Right.
Paniola got a loan from Deutsche
Bank. Allow me to clarify.
Keep that clear in your mind, counsel.
Yes, Judge. Yes, Judge. Sandwich Isles in 2007 approaches NECA and says, we plan to lease the cable's entire capacity from Paniolo. NECA warns Sandwich Isles that the cost and capacity of the cable, the cost and capacity of the lease, I should say, appear excessive given Sandwich Isles' very small customer base. And this is laid out, I believe, at JA9899, and occurs in the May-June 2007 timeframe. In July of 2007, despite those warnings, Sandwich Isles enters an exclusive lease with Paniolo for the cable's entire capacity, despite the fact that the cable's entire capacity appears to be roughly 200 times what Sandwich Isles required.
And up until that moment in time, was Sandwich Isles still using, when it had some prior cable, it was capacity was leasing, was it still doing it up until that moment in time?
Yes, up until that time, Sandwich Isles had been leasing capacity from Hawaiian Telcom. And crucially, the commission found, and Sandwich Isles doesn't meaningfully challenge, that it could have continued to do so to this date and adequately serve the needs of both its current and future customers. And so the commission found that there was no need in the first place, effectively, to build this cable.
To build the cable or to lease the entire cable?
Well, to lease the cable. Sandwich Isles could have continued to serve its ratepayers adequately by leasing capacity from unaffiliated third parties.
The confusion here on building and leasing might be because of the, at least some evidence about the unusual relationship.
Yes, that accounts for the slipping between the terms. But it's correct. It is a putatively different company.
And let's imagine in 2007 when they came and said, "Here's the new. We're still on our old lease." But here's the new lease we'd like to sign on X date in 2007 or 2008, and it's a $24 million lease. And if at that time the association had said no, 24 hours later, or they'd appealed, and within a week or so the commission said, "Are you nuts? There's no way we're going to approve that," would Sandwich Isles wouldn't have been out any money. It would have just done its old lease. Or do we know that it would have been? It wouldn't have lost investment money in this.
I apologize.
Judge Millett. Sandwich Isles didn't invest in anything.
That's what I'm asking my question about.
No, Pina Paniola did.
I'm asking whether they would have lost any money if is the only money outlay in 2007 prospective lease expenses.
My understanding is that. In 2007, they did not have a lease commitment to Paniolo, and that Sandwich Isles
was what they were going to incur.
The question was whether or not was whether they were going to enter this 20-year lease for the Paniolo
Capella. Going forward, that's all. The 24.1 or something was the lease expense going forward.
Yes, that's correct. I think the point is that because this cable was never necessary to serve Sandwich Isles ratepayers, this is exactly the sort of gold plating that the used and useful standard is meant to prevent. And the used and useful standard requires that Sandwich Isles show that the costs it's recovering on an ongoing basis are benefiting ratepayers.
When is the first time that AT&T complained to the FCC?
AT&T, I believe, participated, submitted comments in response to Sandwich Isles' petition for a declaratory ruling asking the FCC to override NECA's determination that these costs shouldn't be included in the pool.
I'm asking for the date.
The precise date? I don't know the precise date, but it was in conjunction with Sandwich Isles' petition.
What year?
It was in 2009 or 10.
Not in 2007?
No, because what happened was in 2007, between when Sandwich Isles approached NECA in 2007 about entering this lease, NECA warned it that it might not be able to recover the costs. Sandwich Isles went ahead, entered the lease, and over the next 2 years, Sandwich Isles and NECA went back and forth with each other over the degree to which these costs should be allowed to be included in the pooling. Finally, in 2009, NECA issued a definitive determination that that costs beyond what Sandwich Isles was previously paying Hawaiian Telecom plus an allowance for growth would not be allowed into NECA pooling. At that point, Sandwich Isles petitioned.
So it's a declaratory ruling.
Exactly, sorry, declaratory ruling.
And that date is, that's 2010?
That is in 2009, I believe, that they seek the declaratory ruling.
That was a 50-50 ruling.
That led to the 50-50 ruling by the Bureau,
right.
Correct.
Got it. Okay.
Did you object, and you objected to the 50-50 ruling before the Commission?
Yes, after the Bureau issued the 50-50 ruling, AT&T filed an application for review.
What date was that?
That was in 2010.
The
Bureau ruling was in September of 2010, I believe, so it was late 2010.
And do you have any explanation as a keen observer on this, why the FCC sat on this case for 6 years?
I can't speculate as to why the FCC sat on the case
knowledge.
For so long.
No, I don't want you to speculate. You don't have any knowledge.
I'm afraid I don't, but I think I would echo my colleague's point that to the extent there was delay in this case, it inured to Sandwich Isles' benefit.
Well, one can imagine it being a problem for others, though, going forward.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do we know if their lease, if not, I'll ask your friend on the other side, but was Sandwich Isles' lease with Paniola Cable at full capacity a year-by-year lease, or was it for a set term of years?
It was a 20-year lease, the price of which escalated over time until it reached a certain cap, and then it leveled off. So, but it was
a
full 20.
Lease as usual? Is that usually how it's done?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Okay.
If the court has no further questions, we'd ask that you deny Sandwich Isles' petition.
Thank you very much. How much time does Mr. Smith have? Okay. Can we give you 2 minutes?
Thank you. I didn't realize the yellow light meant I was done. The design of the network, including the undersea cable, was done in the late 90s. It was approved by the RUS, and it was the entire design of the network as approved was before the Commission when it issued its 2005 order. The Commission knew it would be expensive. The 2005 order contemplates $14,000 per loop per year in cost. You can find that at Joint Appendix 37 and 38, footnote 53. They knew it would serve relatively few customers. There was a change between 2005 and 2016 that can only be explained by the fact that it was arbitrary and capricious. The focus on 2007 as though somebody walked in and shocked and surprised NECA with the plan to build this cable is simply a deception. It's not true. It was on the boards for a long time. It was opposed at every step by the big telecoms, Hawaiian Tel, Verizon, etc. Their position has not changed. From the outset, they said it was too expensive, it was unnecessary, etc. And they've been very consistent. The only party that's changed is the FCC. No facts have changed. The FCC changed for no reason, and they're going to drive my client out of business with this decision.
Who is your client?
My client, Sandwich Isles Communications.
Not Paniolo.
Not Paniolo.
And Paniolo is the one with the capital investment.
Paniolo is the one that borrowed the money.
Paniolo is the one that's with the capital investment.
Yes, the arrangement.
And they're not in front of us.
I'll just explain. The arrangement was Sandwich Isles entered a lease for the full capacity of cable, and Paniolo doesn't even have a bank account. Paniolo's only account is in Deutsche Bank, so that when the rent goes to Paniolo, it goes straight to Deutsche Bank.
All I want to
but
make
that
clear,
is, but that is the arrangement.
I want to make clear is Sandwich Islands is before us, Paniolo is not.
Absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Sandwich Isles is locked into a 20-year lease.
Which it can't pay.
But that seems a little inconsistent with your position for the commission that actually it's not locked into a 20-year lease of $24.1 million, but actually we can knock it down to $8.1 million. So maybe you weren't so locked in at all. They were just totally renegotiated.
Well,
so maybe they could renegotiate some more. I mean, how are we supposed to know, you know, how locked in or how reliant you were?
Understood, Your Honor. Keep in mind that Deutsche Bank was recognizing the same reality we were, that we weren't going to get the $24 million. So they were kind of flexible about what they would be willing to do, too.
Okay.
But there isn't any margin for anybody between the rent for anybody except Deutsche Bank. The full amount of the rent to Paniolo goes straight to Deutsche Bank. That was the point I wanted to make sure you understood.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.